This is how this one is going to be. Except I want to share one thing with you, because this is an honest program. Being fairly new in it, and being, when I learned that I was going to be a part of this program, it was bandied about who's going to be the speaker. And somebody says it's going to be Clarence S. And I said, who is Clarence S? And they started telling me about him, and that's where I got my first misinformation. They said that he is one of the first 100. Well, he's not one of the first 100, he's one of the first 40. But you know, he was messing around with this outfit called the Oxford Group back in 1938. Well, you know, since I sobered up, I'm able to do some basic arithmetic, and so I got to figuring that if this guy came in 1938, and he's talking to us in 1975, who's going to meet the plane and help him off of it? And so, I was privileged to be out at the airport to meet this guy. And I was not prepared for what I saw, because he did not walk off of the plane, he jumped off of it, and not only that, he was bringing this beautiful thing along with him, and the first words he said, well, fellas, since I'm going to be here 3 days, I just brought the sex maniac along with me. But that's not the end of it. We went into the airport and we're waiting on his luggage, and as this so often happens, they lost it. And I thought to myself, my gosh, what's this guy going to say? He comes, of all of the glamorous places in the world he's been, and to come to Topeka, Kansas is enough, but to lose his luggage. And you know what he said? And this is as true as it can be. He just smiled and he said, I'm so thankful that having come into this program, I have something to lose. And that's the kind of a guy that we have here today. And with that, I'd like to introduce to you Clarence S.
Well, thank you very much, Jim. I'm certainly pleased to be here. And I do want to thank all of you for inviting Grace and I to come and share this event with you. And before I do anything else, I want you to meet Grace. I refer to her as Amazing Grace. She is my bride of 4 years. And she is probably the greatest thing that ever happened to me since I came into this fellowship in 1938. Stand up, Grace, and say hello. Makes her so nice. She's also a rummy and has about 8 years in this program. She's an alcoholic. So that makes me an AA, and it also makes me an Al-Anon. So I'm both. Why, to speak to a crowd such as this is a great privilege. And sometimes you wonder how to start. I never have any prepared talks. We had you stand up for a moment or so a while ago to rest your little behind, and believe me, you're going to need it. Someone asked me how long I was going to talk. I said, how long do I have? And he says, well, take as long as you want. And so this was all kicked around a little while, and then I was informed over here by our tape crew over here. Ed tells me that he has 100 two-hour tapes at his disposal. And he wanted to know if I thought that was enough. Well, I think we'll make it. Well, we're here to talk about rummies and alcoholism and how to, what blessings we've received here. First blessing we have since we've landed here is the terrific weather that we brought to you from Florida. I didn't know about this when I changed planes in Atlanta. I had the roughest trip, I believe, I've ever had on an airplane between Orlando and Atlanta. It was the most miserable weather, and the plane I was on happened to be the last one that landed on that type of a strip. The thing was going like this, and it's one of these great big 10-11 planes, too. And that was bobbing around like a cork. And when that Atlanta, that rain was pouring down in sheets. But when we came, got over here, this was lovely. But while my luggage got lost, they did ship the weather along all right. So here we are. Let's talk about some of the friends I've met here that I've met in years past. It's really nice to see some of my old friends. And it's awfully nice to meet a lot of new ones. I am a fundamentalist in AA. I have never become a graduate. My practically 38 years of sobriety in this fellowship has been one that I have tried to follow out things that were taught me by my sponsor and the other people who preceded me, and then by dumb ignorance and luck and blessings, I have learned a good many other things, which has given me many blessings during my lifetime here. And I'd like to share some of these things with you today, and I'd like to talk about how this AA got started. You heard some history this morning about the New York area, and which was fine, and they do have a history, but I was not raised in New York AA. I was raised in Midwestern AA. I was raised in Ohio. My sponsor was Dr. Bob, and he taught me certain things, and he was a tough sponsor. I want you to know that, let me tell you something, some of the things about how I got here. This might be a good way to start. Because in a good many ways, I am a freak in AA. I have a lot of firsts. For instance, I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. There was no AA when I arrived here. I became a member of the Oxford movement, which you heard Lois refer to this morning. Bill also was indoctrinated into the Oxford movement in New York. And I was indoctrinated in it in Akron, Ohio. Frankly, I didn't know what I was into. The only thing is, I want to tell you how this happened. I was on the bum. I had managed to drink myself out of jobs. I was unemployable. If you don't think I was unemployable, I'll tell you a few things to just wisen you up a little bit. I came into this fellowship in the depth of a depression, and these were in WPA days, and also prohibition days. There was no booze when I came in here. Booze had been outlawed, so there wasn't any. But I wound up an alcoholic regardless of that. And I was married into a very clannish family at the time. Lois knows some of my ex-family. And I always had one, two, three, or four of them at my home at some time or other, usually all at once. And these people dictated policy in my home. And I didn't have much to say about it, and they used to have family meetings in my home, and they had these family meetings and discussions And I was never invited to these discussions because I was generally the subject under discussion. And the discussions generally ran along the line as to whether or not they're going to throw me out again or let me back in again in my own home. Well, the time arrived finally that they gave me my one big last chance to stay with this august body. And this chance was predicated upon the idea that I should go to work for my wife's brother, Dorothy's brother. And he had a truck and a trailer, and he hauled merchandise from Cleveland to New York and back in this big tractor-trailer rig. And I was to become his helper. Now, that has been way over 40 years ago, and to this day, I haven't had my hand on the wheel of that truck yet. First of all, when they put this proposition up to me, it scared me to death. I'd never been on a truck in my life, let alone drive one. And I knew this would be hard work, and I've always been adverse to hard work. I still am. I never got over that. I like hard work. I can lay right down the side of it and let it go, you know. It doesn't bother me a bit. But anyway, I had to take this challenge and agree to go on this job. So I shall never forget, we started off one, it was the beginning of winter, and we started off for New York on a trip, hauling merchandise. And it was one of those sleeper cabs where I was to sleep up and up above where the driver is, and he'd sleep on the seat when any sleeping was to be done. He had fixed up that little niche for me real nice and put a lace curtain and everything up there for me. It was real sweet. And I got up in that thing, and it scared me to death. I'd look out that window and watch that big trailer following me down with 20 tons of merchandise in it. And this scared the liver out of me. I was a chronic alcoholic. I was not a periodic, which means I was a consistent person. You could always depend on me. I was not one of these periodics. You know, there's two types of rummies that we have to contend with, the periodic and the chronic. Now, I'm a chronic. I'm drunk all the time, so people know what to expect from me. But these blooming periodics, these are the people that ought to be barred from everything. They are the people who give alcoholics a bad name. They do, you know. You figure it out. And these are the first ones that squawk when they get to step two and you start talking about sanity. They're the ones that tell you they're not nuts, you know. Now, listen, let me give you a description of these apes. This fella, he gets a good job. He has a nice home, a nice family. He has a couple of cars in the garage, nice place to live in. Everything is going fine. And all of a sudden, without rhyme or reason, this dodo gets drunk, and believe me, it's a disaster area. Everything goes. The house goes, the furniture goes, the cars go back to the finance company, the wife goes, the kids go, everybody goes. The whole works is washed out with this periodic guy. What happens to this fella? First thing you know, he goes out and gets another job. And you know what kills me? He generally gets a better one than he had before. I have a resentment toward these people. And then he gets himself a new house, new furniture, new wife, new family, new everything, and starts all over again. And he starts climbing up that ladder, gets the little green stuff in his pocket, gets some jingle in his pocket, and gets his bank account. Everything going great. He gets reestablished in society and accepted back in the human race. And what does he do? The same thing over again. This is a repetition. He blows it all again, and then the whole thing crashes down. He lives. This is his way of life. And then he's the first guy, when you're talking that second step about restoring the sanity, perhaps, he's the guy that says, "Me nuts? I'm not crazy. I wonder what you call this kind of thing, this kind of behavior. Now, I never did that kind of stuff. So I resent people like that, naturally. Well, now, I'm a chronic, and we start off on this trip to New York, and my brother-in-law, naturally, the last thing he'd ever do would be buy me a drink, because he's taking me there to cure me from drinking. And I am sick, and I am shaking, and I'm in a terrible shape, and I don't have any clothes to wear to amount to anything, and the winter's setting in. And I'm up in that coop that he puts me in, and I'm shivering and shaking and scared to death. And he drives and drives and drives. I thought, does this guy ever stop for a rest? No. And I was trying to figure ways to get away from him. Before I started on this trip, I had secreted, I think, about $1.20 in dimes around my person. I had them in various pockets so they wouldn't rattle. And he didn't know that I possessed this capital. Okay? I probably stole it from some church collection, but I had it anyway. And I used to sell milk bottles and pick up bottles and trade them in for money like that. I used to pick up money in odd ways when it was laying around loose. Well, anyway, I had this capital, and he didn't know about this. And we stopped the next morning. I can remember this. We just passed over in a New York state. And he stopped at one of those roadside stands for breakfast. And his breakfast consisted of tomato juice and some cheese and all that sort of stuff. And boy, the thought of it made me ill. I couldn't handle it, of course. So then he gets back in the truck and on we go. And we rode and rode and rode till the following night we land into Albany, New York. Well, this is the first time he finally got tired enough to conk out. He had to rest. So he pulls his outfit over to the curbstone, parked it, and he told me he's going to take a nap for about an hour and a half. I thought, boy, this is great. So I says, that's wonderful. I says, this is Albany. This is the capital of New York. I always wanted to see the Capitol buildings. So this is the first chance I had to get away from this bird, and away I went. Well, I got into the first place I ran into. I saw this was not a place for a man of my means, so I left and I went down the street further and found a place that is more suitable to a man of my estate, a real joint. And I got in there with my $1.20, which is enough to start any place in those days. And I found an angel in there, and this angel was a little odd, this fellow was. I knew he had some ideas. And he was buying me drinks like they were going out of style. And I was throwing them in about as fast as I could handle them. And then I left, I went in the men's room and went out a window and went the other way. And I left, see? Well, I guess he had to pick up the check. I'm not interested in those details. I know I left. And I started back for this truck, and not having had a drink for a day or two there, I guess these things hit me all at once when I was walking back there. And this boy is lying on his seat down there sleeping, and I attempted to crawl up into my nest, and in so doing, I stepped on this poor boy's face. And, of course, he came to life, and he realized that something was amiss here, and I smelled like a distillery. So church was out. So he drove me into New York City and threw me out. And there he left me there. He says, this is the end of the line. Don't ever come back to Cleveland. You're done. Nobody wants you there. You're not welcome. You're strictly on your own. Goodbye and go someplace, you know? So he wrote Dorothy, who was my wife at the time, and told her what he'd done, I guess. I only knew one person in New York City. Now, I want to tell you about the first miracle that has happened to me. My life is a succession of miracles. And I suspect every person here has some miracles in their lives that they can point to. And the greatest miracle is that you ever found AA. But my first miracle occurred in New York City. I had never been in New York before. I knew nothing about it. I only knew one person in New York City. And this wasn't a very promising situation because it was another sister of his, one of the in-laws. I knew Virginia. And Lois knows Virginia McLeod very well, because eventually she wound up in AA too. Now here's what happened. I figured that here I am standing out here in New York. I don't have any money left. My capital had been shot in this joint. And I'm 600 miles from home, and I had to find some way to exist. And I thought certainly Virginia, who lived in Yonkers, I had been there on my honeymoon, so I knew where she lived. They were a very clannish family. We did everything together. And we honeymooned at her home, the whole family. Well, anyway, I made my way out to Yonkers to see Virginia. Thinking she'd help me, and I figured she ought to, because she owed me some things. And I think I was right in my assumption there. But she didn't agree wholeheartedly. Because I got out there, and I can only remember a couple items about that trip. First of all, Virginia lived way up on top of a hill, on Palisades there. But I didn't go up on that hill when I arrived in Yonkers. I went down the hill into the Italian section. And the Italian people in those days, they all made wine. I guess they still do. But a lot of them sold it in those days, and some of them shared it with their friends. And I went down in this Italian section, and I made friends. And I got myself slopped with this Dago Red. And by the time I got up to Virginia's house, I was probably a mess to observe, you know. But I only remember a couple things about that. I remember rolling around on the floor with her two little kids. She had two little baby daughters, about 2 and 3 years old. And I'm rolling around the floor with them. Now remember, I'm drunk, I'm dirty, and I stink. So Virginia takes a dim view of this deal. So she doesn't do anything but load me in the back of her car and take me down to that waterfront where her brother had thrown me out, and she did likewise. Now, this sounds like a sad tale. I remember that day, something that happened that day I shall never, never forget. I stood down there in that waterfront, and it occurred to me that day that I'm alone in this world. I'm 600 miles from home, and it wouldn't have made any difference if I was 6 feet from home. I wasn't welcome anyway. And it occurred to me that there wasn't one person in this whole world who cared one bit whether I was alive or dead. I shall never forget that feeling. Never. Well, I had to do something, and I survived. I'm not going into all the details of how I did this, but I did. As you see, I'm here. But something happened. Sometime later, Virginia had her doctor over there to talk to her, or see one of the kids, I guess. I don't know what the occasion was. But two of them got to talking about drinking, which was always a good topic in those days. And Virginia told her doctor about this visit of this brother-in-law of hers, who used to be such a nice guy, her favorite brother-in-law, and who's such a dirty, stinking, drunken bum now. And this doctor says, you know, that's odd. Says, I have a brother-in-law who was a lush like that, and he met some strange cult of people. And since he met this cult, he don't drink anymore, and he runs all over New York trying to fix drunks. And he says there's a Dr. Smith down in Akron, Ohio, who also belongs to this cult in Akron, and he spends all of his time fixing drunks. And he says if your brother-in-law ever gets back to Cleveland, maybe he can go down and see this Dr. Smith in Akron, Ohio, and maybe this doctor can fix him. Well, this doctor happened to be Dr. Leonard Strong, who happens to be Lois's brother-in-law, right? And that's the fellow. Now, this is way back. way back in the early 30s when this happened. Now, what do you think of the mathematical chances of me being here? There was a few fellas in New York City, Bill Wilson and a few of his cronies, who were doing their best to try to keep on the ball here and preach the sermon to people. And there was a handful of them up in Akron, Ohio. And I'm in New York, where I know nobody, and this is all going on. Here I am coming into contact indirectly with the two main moguls of the beginning of this fellowship, unknown to me. So Virginia wrote Dorothy the news about this doctor in Akron and told her that if I ever showed up, she should chase me down to Akron or take me down and meet this doctor, and maybe I could get fixed too. I don't know how long I stayed in New York. It was a long time, I know this, because there was bad weather again when I left. Everything happened to me at the beginning of winter. I don't know why this is. Everything happened to me in lousy weather. And I got myself back to Cleveland. One fella took me to Erie, I remember, one trucker, and another one drove me the rest of the way into where I lived outside of Cleveland. And I thought, well, I lived in a snow belt in Cleveland. I lived in what they call Lyndhurst, Ohio, they have snow there up to 1st of July in that village. I don't know why, but it's just one of those things. But this was in the middle of winter, and I headed for my house. And I noted one thing when I got up on the front porch. The screens were still up, and the snow was this deep on the ground. I had to wade through this snow to get on the porch. And the screen doors are up, and the screens are up and everything. And I get up and pound on the door, and Dorothy came to the door, my wife. And, of course, she talked to me through the screen door. I didn't get in, see? And so in the conversation, I pointed out to her that these screens should not be up in the house in the middle of winter, that she needed a man around the house to take care of those details. But she allowed us how she did need a man around the house, but she sure didn't need one that badly. So I didn't get in, but she did tell me about this Dr. Smith in Akron, and would I like to meet him. So Virginia had communicated about Dr. Strong and so forth, and Dr. Smith, so Dorothy asked me if I'd like to meet this Dr. Smith, and I told her, yes, I had nothing to lose. So Dorothy put me in her automobile, took me down to the bus depot, and bought me a one-way ticket to Akron. And she gave me Doc Smith's name and address, and that's how I met my sponsor. And eventually, Doc put me in Akron City Hospital, in Akron, Ohio, and that is how I started my career in this fellowship. And in that hospital, I met the men down there who had preceded me in the fellowship. These fellows all belonged to the Oxford movement. They were all rummies who came to see me. I still have their names. They all put their names on a sheet of paper when they come to visit me. And those fellas all told me the story of their lives with alcohol, what had happened to them. And now they are without drinking and feeling pretty good about it. And those men did something to me. They inspired me. They had something I wanted. And I felt like you heard read a while ago, this fifth chapter, that feeling I had says if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you're not ready to take certain steps. Well, we didn't have steps then. We didn't have the book. We didn't have the AA program then. They hadn't come into being yet. But these men, their power of example did something to me. They told me their stories, and I related to those fellas. They are all older men than I was. That's why I've outlived them all, I guess. They were all fellas 45, 50 years old and up. And I had just passed my 35th birthday at this time. You don't have to take your shoes off. I'll tell you, I'll be 73 years old next Christmas. So, those fellas were considerably older, but they had the same experiences, and I did in the 8 or 9 years of my drinking what it took some of those fellas 30 to do, believe me. I was one of these fellas that didn't do any fooling when it come to boozing. I do everything this way. I still do. Part of the nature of the beast. I'm an extremist like every rummy is. Well, anyway, these men impressed me, and I wanted to be one of them. I didn't belong to anything. I didn't even belong to the human race, really. From that feeling I had standing on that waterfront, I didn't feel I belonged anywhere. But these fellas were the first people that showed me any love or consideration. And I wanted to be one of those in the worst way, so I shall never forget the last day I was in this hospital. My sponsor, Doc, came in, and as he always did every day, he came in and he sat on in the afternoon of this last day. I was in there a week. And he sat on the foot of my bed, which is a very unprofessional posture, but he always did this. He did things different than other doctors did. And he looked at me. He says, "Well, young fella," he says, "what do you think of all these things by now?" He had a name for everyone. I don't think he knew the names of any of the fellas. He had a name he tacked on all of us. I was always young fella to him. The only time that I was ever Clarence to him is when he was mad at me. When he'd holler, "Clarence," he had that Vermont accent, that heavy accent. "Clarence," when he hollered that, I know I'm in trouble. But when he calls me young fella, things are going along all right. So this day, everything's all right because I'm just getting started here. And he says, "Young fella, what do you think of all this by now?" I says, "Doc, I think this is wonderful." I says, "All these fellas coming in, I don't know them from a load of hay. And they all telling me the stories of their lives and what had happened to them through booze." He says, "Yeah." I says, "But there's one thing that puzzles me." He says, "And what's that?" I said, "They all tell me the same thing before they leave. They tell me that they have the answer to my drinking problem, but they leave on that note and they don't tell me what the answer is." I says, "What happens to me now? What are you going to do? What's the answer to this thing?" I had all kinds of little things running around in this blubber about what's going to happen. I was looking for an operation. I'll tell you why. The first time I went down to see Doc, I ran out on him. He scared me to death. But I went down, when Dorothy put me in that car and took me down, I went up to his office, which is on the 6th floor of the Second National Bank building in Akron. And he wasn't in his office when I got there, so I figured I'd have to wait. And it was cold outside, and I didn't want to leave because it was cold and it was warm in there. If I got out on the street, I might get picked up anyway, so I thought I better stay in there. So I spent my time walking up and down the hallway there and keep passing his office all the time. And every time I'd pass his office, I would just automatically look at the window, and there's a sign on there, "Dr. Robert Holbrook Smith, rectal surgeon." Yes, sir. It occurred to me that this is a certainly new approach to alcoholism. So I was expecting anything. But here when I asked Doc, I says, "What are you going to do to me? Where do I go? What's what? What's next? I've been in here a week." I'll never forget this. Old Doc always gave me the round-the-barn treatment. He always gave me the negative treatment. He always shook me up. He was tough. He looks at me and says, "Well, young fella, we don't know about you. You're pretty young. And we don't know if you've had enough yet." Jesus, I weigh 130 pounds. I hadn't worked in 3 years. On the bum all this time, over 3 years. I was unemployable. And if you don't think I was unemployable, let me tell you this.
These were WPA days, you know. And anybody, but anybody, ought to be able to get on WPA. A lot of you people aren't old enough to remember WPA, but I see some gray heads around here and bald heads that can remember it. This is a thing that Roosevelt instituted back in the deepest depression days to try to help people keep body and soul together. They had all kinds of projects, fixing roads, fixing streets, just digging up things and digging up holes and filling them again, doing anything. But they paid you $18 a week for this. They give you 45 cents an hour. That was a going rate for labor in those days. So people, anyone who wanted to, could get themselves down to the office, could get on WPA. That is all but me. All my jug buddies got on WPA and they wouldn't take me. Now, if you can imagine, a guy that can't get on WPA, he has to be a pretty sorry mess. That gives you one idea, and that isn't bad enough. Dorothy was always very much interested in my going to work. And she did her best. And do you know what Dorothy's job was? Dorothy was the head of the men's department in an employment agency. And she couldn't get me a job. So this is my situation. And 130 pounds, and so mixed up that I couldn't find my way out of a telephone booth. I was so screwed up. So Doc hands me that bill of goods about maybe I haven't had enough yet. I'm not old enough yet, see? Well, I practically had to fight my way into this thing. I had to convince him that I was ready to quit drinking. I think that had a lot to do with that part in that fifth chapter. It says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you're ready now, you know. I certainly was ready, and I convinced him I was. He says, okay, young fellow, I'll give you the answer to all this thing. Now, here's the way this program was introduced to me. Doc says, I'll give you the answer. He says, get down off of that bed. I says, for what? He says, get down on that floor, you're gonna pray. I says, who's gonna pray? He says, you're gonna pray. I says, I don't know anything about praying. He says, I don't suppose you do. But he says, I'll pray, and that'll do for this time. He had first asked me if I believed in God, you know. And I when he told me this, when he asked this God business, this shook me up. I didn't want any part of this God situation, so I had to evade this question. But Doc is a person you don't evade. So when he said, do I believe in God, I had to beat this one. So I, the best I can come up with, I says, what does that have to do with it? He said, young fellow, that has everything to do with it. Do you or do you not believe in God? Well, this man wants an answer. So the next best thing I came along with was, well, I guess I do. He says, there's no guessing about it, you do or you don't. Now, how do you like this approach for people starting in AA, you know? These squeamish guys about the God angle. He made me admit, I finally admitted that I did believe in God. He says, okay, now we can get someplace. That's when he tumbled me out of that hay right on that cold concrete in that shorty nightgown on my bare knees. Cold February day. And he uttered a prayer, and he had me repeat it after him. I don't remember what it was. I wish I did, but I can imagine what it was. But I remember this, after we concluded that little prayer, he shook hands with me. He said, young fellow, you're going to be all right. That night he carried me to this meeting of the Oxford Movement. Well, I didn't know what I was going into, and I got my first big shock when I went into this Oxford group meeting. It was at the home of T. Henry and Clarissa Williams in Akron. They were the head moguls in the Oxford Movement down in that area,
and they had all of their meetings in their home. They had a beautiful, sumptuous home there. And T. Henry had a big living room, and he had a recreation room down in the basement there. And I went to this meeting, and I looked around at all these people, and it scared to death. I got scared to death at this thing, because there were a lot of women in there, and I couldn't understand what they're doing there. And I knew that I was mixed up with a bunch of rummies, but what all those women were doing there and his ladies, I couldn't figure them out. And an awful lot of people who were not alcoholics. The alcoholics were a minority group in those days in the Oxford group by a long shot. We were in there on sufferance. The Oxford group people were so convicted that they could help anyone through spiritual means that they tackle anybody. It didn't make any difference what your problem was. They figured that you could find it through turning your will and your life over to the care of God and doing certain things according to how they set up and did them. And so they tackled the alcoholics, and this was the biggest mistake the Oxford group ever made, because we damn near ruined them. But anyway, I got in there, and I looked around and I see all these people, and these women scared me. I'm not frightened of girls anymore. I love them now, but I gotten over that with the years. But I was scared, and I felt like a fish out of water. But I went, and I went down there every Wednesday night to meetings to Akron, Ohio. And it took me a long time to figure out just what I was belonging to down there. I'd go down weekends to be with these people, the alcoholics, and I went Wednesday night to be at the regular meetings. And I had a 75-mile round trip to go to meetings. People don't have that today. I didn't have the transportation facilities you have today either. And I didn't have the other advantages a lot of people have, money and one thing and another. But anyway, Dorothy, after I got into the Oxford group, she let me come back home. See, this boy's going to get fixed. I'm going to be all right and go to work and be a gentleman and be a real father and a family man. So she let me come back home. I guess Doc must have had something to do with that. So I moved in, and the next thing you know, I'm running all over creation. My sponsor told me that I would have to spend the rest of my life fixing drunks. He says, you're the only person can do it. You're an alcoholic and no one else can fix drunks but another rummy. And he said, you'll have to go out and spend your life as an avocation, he said. You're going to have to make a living, but you'll have to do this as an avocation, to spend your life fixing drunks, because you are qualified to do it, and you are an expert in it, having lived through it. And he convinced me this is what I'd have to do with my life. And I guess he really convinced me, because I've still been doing it all these years. I'm still at it. And it's a great thing as far as I'm concerned. Well, anyway, here's what happened to me. I was very much interested in what Lois said this morning about her frustrations with Bill after he got sober. And I lived right with her on this morning, because that same thing happened to me. I was the nobody in that family. I was the nothing and less than nothing. And all of a sudden I get important. I become important to people. You understand, in those days we had no central office, we had no literature, we had no book, we had none of these advantages that people have today. We had no groups. We had nothing. This was all pioneering. I had to go out and meet rummies any place I could do and try to shake them down and pound this idea into them. So I relieved my sponsor and I went back to Cleveland, and I became the first and foremost bar stool snatcher in history. I went every place where there were rummies. And I went every place who had anything to do with rummies. I went to doctors, I went to psychiatrists, I went to clergymen, I went to the Associated Charities, I went all in, and the judges and police and everybody, to work on the rummies that were giving them problems. And they gave me plenty of rummies to work on, believe me.
A rummy was in danger for me. When I see a rummy someplace, boy, he got a pitch. But I didn't have any success doing this. You know, I was driven by something there that I felt that I'd never really be a real member of this, never really be an Indian. I'd never win my feather till I had sponsored somebody. I wanted to get some guy down in that hospital in Akron, Ohio, and that was my goal. And I felt that I would be accomplishing something if that would ever happen. I'd be a real accepted member of the fellowship. Do you know there was no shortage of rummies in those days? There was a depression on, a lot of people not working. You could find them everywhere. There was tons of them around. And it took me 7 long, heart-rending months and talking to hundreds of rummies before I ever got my first one in that hospital. And I shall never forget that first fella that I sponsored. I can look back now and see why it took me 7 long months to get my first rummy. After that, they seemed to come real fast. Now, I know now why it took me 7 months to get my first baby. And then I know why, right immediately after it, a whole bunch start coming. It says something in our 5th chapter about carrying a message. I just didn't have a message. I had a lot of steam, a lot of brass, a lot of gall, a lot of ego and what have you, and a lot of time. But I had no message. It took me 7 months to get that message that I finally put across to Bill Hess. Then immediately a whole flock of Irishmen came in. Holy smokes. What would we do without the Irish? I always say this is an Irish disease that's cured in Methodist church basements. Had another Irishman shortly after that, and Cooney knows him. I think he's a relative of his. Al Goldrick. And Al was in a... I chased that guy all winter long, and finally landed him into City Hospital in Akron. We were having trouble in the Oxford movement. The rummies were having trouble with the civilians. The book was written in the fall of 1938, and this is in May 1939. Al Goldrick was in the hospital there, and we were trying to fix him. They were talking, he was getting the same treatment I was getting. But here's what happened. Out of the first 14 men that we got in Cleveland, half of them were Roman Catholics. The Oxford group was a religious group, and it was a Protestant situation. And they went through all kinds of things that the Catholic Church would not stand still for. So the Catholics didn't feel they could belong to this Oxford group, which caused us a great problem. So I went down to see my sponsor, Doc Smith, about it, and I explained to him what we were up against. I says, Doc, you know, these fellas can't come. I says, they can't belong to an Oxford group. I says, we don't need all this falder all over the Oxford group. We can eliminate a lot of this stuff. We have a book now with 12 steps, and we have the 4 absolutes, and anyone can live with that. He says, well, you can't do that. He says, you can't break this thing up. I said, we're not breaking anything up. All I'm interested in is something with more universality to it, so anybody can belong, whether they have religion or believe in anything or not. They can come. He says, well, you can't do that. I said, we're going to do something. And he says, like what? I says, well, we'll see like what. Now, this is my break with my sponsor. I'm 15 months sober, and I'm telling my sponsor all about it, which I don't know why I waited that long. People today don't do that. They start right off the first meeting. Well, anyway, I went out to see Al's wife. They had a big home. Al had a big home on the Heights.
Cal was a lawyer. He was getting kicked out of his law firm at the time. He was about to lose his home, too. But he saved the whole thing. The whole thing was salvaged. So I talked to his wife, Grace, about using their home for a meeting place. We didn't know anything about meeting halls. We didn't have any money anyway. So she was delighted with the idea of having a meeting in her home. So I went down to Akron the next Wednesday night and made this announcement, and here's how the split came, and here's how AA started as AA. The book had come out in February of 39, and this is May of 39, 3 months later. I went down to the meeting in Akron, says, this is the last time the Cleveland contingent will be down here as a group. We are going to start our own group in Cleveland, Ohio, and I made the mistake of giving them the address at 2345 Stillman Road, Cleveland Heights. I shouldn't have done that. And I says, this is not going to be an Oxford group. It's going to be known as Alcoholics Anonymous. We're taking the name from the book, and only alcoholics and their families are welcome, nobody else. Well, you figure this out. We were a minority group. We, the alcoholics, were most of these people, were civilians in this outfit. And here we are, breaking away from them. Well, to say the least, it was a riot. The roof came off the house. Clarence, you can't do this. It's done. You must come down and talk about it. There's nothing to talk about. Well, if I thought that was a riot there in Akron that night, I wish you'd have seen it 2345 Stillman Road the next week on Thursday night. That whole group descended upon us and tried to break up our meeting. One guy was going to whip me. Now, I know. I want you to know this is all done in pure Christian love. But we stood our ground, and that's how AA started. AA started in a riot. It grows in riots. Some donkey put something in about unity here. If we ever had unity, you know what would happen? We'd have one great big group with about five people doing all the work and the rest of them getting drunk. We are the proponents of disunity. Nobody ever goes out and starts a group because we need a group. Somebody gets mad at somebody. And we choose up sides. We stay together, we'll kill each other. We get apart and everybody does all right. So I saw the first AA group. Now there's probably 30-some thousand of them around the world. I looked at that group one night at Al Goldrick's house, and I said to myself, I still remember this. I said, boy, if we ever had as many as 35 members, wouldn't this be some group, you know? It wasn't 2 years, we had 35 groups already, see? 35 groups, and I mean, it wasn't groups like you see today, the same people go in every group. They were identified, they had their own identity, they had their own officers, so different people. Yeah, other people go and visit these groups, but there's actually 35 groups. And from that point on, I don't know how many hundred they got up there now. But it's the same in all big cities and all small cities. Now, AA started as a gift of God. Let me tell you something. Why do people walk into this fellowship and they've been drunk X number of years, they've been done all this trouble, they've been in jail, they've been kicked out of jail, they've been in nut houses, they've lost jobs, they've lost families, they've lost all their resources, they've lost their sanity, they've lost their direction completely. And they walk through the door of this AA meeting and bingo! They get sober and stay that way. Why? Why does this? Let me tell you something about alcoholism. Alcoholism is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. You read about alcoholism in ancient history. You read about it in mythology. You read about it in the Bible. There's some awful good rummy stories in the Bible. You don't have to go any further than the first book of the Bible, the book of Genesis, and you meet your first rummy, your first drunk. Meet our friend Noah. He was one of us. You read that story, and you'll know that he's one of us. Well, you figure this out. Here's this guy. Noah was a God-fearing man. And the world got itself into about the kind of a shape it's in now. Everything going down the pits. Everybody going to hell in a basket, you know? Everything. Values and everything gone. Everybody doing as their doggone please. The devil with tomorrow or today. So God decided he's going to wipe the whole thing out and start all over again. He don't see any way he's going to change them. So he gets his friend Noah. He says, Noah, my boy, he says, I want you to do something for me. He says, anything, Lord. He said, I want you to build a big boat. And he gave him the dimensions of this thing. And he says, when you get this built, he says, I want you to put two of everything living in there and your family. He said, Noah says, why? He said, I'm going to destroy this whole world and I need seed to start again. And your family will be seed and these living creatures that you take in there will be the seed to start a new situation. Okay, I'll do it, Lord. So Noah and his family get out there cutting wood and pounding and making this big boat, and the neighbors come by and they say, what are you doing, Noah? Building a boat. He said, a boat out here in the middle of the desert? You know, you've got to be gone. You've got to be gone. He says, sure. He says, why? He says, the world's going to be flooded. Everything's going to be destroyed. Well, then they know he's nuts, you know. And they laugh at him, but he keeps on pounding away and builds the boat. Finally, it gets built, and sure enough, he fills it up as God had ordained that he should do. And boy, it started to rain. And it rained and rained and rained and it rained for 40 days and 40 nights. And that old boat came up, 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 up. It starts to floating around for several months. Finally, the water started to recede. And that boat landed on Mount Ararat. And the water went down and there's the land. What was the first thing our friend Noah did? Our friend Noah. He ran up there, he planted a vineyard, he raised some grapes, he made some wine, and he got drunk. Read the story. Okay, the first rummy in the Bible. You want to hear a couple more rummy stories in the Bible? I'll tell you a couple anyway if you want to hear them or not. I like that story of the Jericho Road. The Good Samaritan. Here's a rummy story, and everybody in it's a rummy. Picture this. Here's this fella lying out on the side of the road, stripped naked, all beat up and half dead. He don't have a stitch of clothing on him. Everything gone. Okay? What do you think happened to that guy? He got drunk and he got rolled. I don't suppose any of you ever got rolled, but he did. He's lying out there, so here's what happens. This priest comes along and he sees him lying there. And he's a man of the world. He's seen rummies rolled before. And he looks at this bird. And he says, good enough for him, the dirty, stinking, drunken bum. He got himself in that shape. Let him get himself out of it as best he can. So he crosses on the other side of the road and leaves that rummy lying there in his misery. Then along come this next fella, the Levite. And he sees this fellow, and he's also a man of the world. Same thing. He says the same thing that the priest said. And it's the same thing we hear today. Don't you ever kid yourself you don't hear it. It's still, it's been ingrown in the priest. That's been handed down for generations. So he crosses on the other side of the road. He isn't going to bother with that dirty, stinking, drunken bum. So then comes this Samaritan guy. Well, the Samaritans were not the chosen people there at the time. And he's a traveling salesman. I'll prove that to you. And he's making this territory. So he comes along on his former conveyance. I'm sure it wasn't a Chevrolet. It was probably a mule. And he sees this fellow lying there, and he's a man of the world, too. He's a rummy. And he recognizes the earmarks immediately. So what did he do? Did he pass him by? Nope. He got down off of his former conveyance and he ministered to him. And what does it say he did? He gave him a drink, just the medicine he needed. He gave him wine. See? Well, did he leave him lie there? Nope. He picked him up and he put him on his former conveyance and he took him to the Holiday Inn, or the inn. And here's how I know they're all rummies. He says, "Mr. Innkeeper, take care of this fellow. Here's some money." You see, he handed the money to the innkeeper, not the rummy. He says, "And here's how I know he's a salesman making the territory." He says, "If there be any more due, I will repay you on my next trip." So you see, he picked him up. That's the first 12-step call on record. It's in the Bible. Boy, I'm telling you. Stories. I love that story of the two boys, the prodigal son. This is a terrific story. Get this one. Here's these two boys. They're Jewish kids. And the old man has a big spread. So, of course, when the father dies, all the loot is going to be divided between the two sons. So these two boys are helping the father run this farm. He has everything on there. He's got cows and sheep and goats, no hogs, but everything else. He has his whole thing all set up. And these kids are working there. And this one kid, the older kid, boy, he's a busy guy. He does more than his father ever expects him to do. He's a busy one. He's the Al-Anon kid. But the other, the young one, guess who? He can't wait till some indefinite time when his father dies. He wants his right now when he's young and can enjoy it. So he keeps bugging his father and bugging his father and bugging his father for his share of the loot. And finally the father can't take it anymore. He says, "Okay, take your share and be gone." And boy, that kid was be gone too. And what does it say happened? It says he went into a far country and he squandered his substance in riotous living. Did you ever hear of a thing like that? He blew the whole bundle. He's tapped out, he's flat, and that isn't the worst yet. A famine set in, and he can't get anything to eat, and he's a stranger in a foreign country. And he's in a pickle, this guy. So he's trying to survive, like I did when I was on the waterfront in New York. I can always remember this fella for my own experience. So what does he do? You know what kind of a job he got? The only thing he got a job on a hog farm, taking care of a bunch of hogs. Remember, this kid's a Jew. Did he eat what the hogs ate? No, it's not on your life. The Bible says he ate of the husks of the hogs. He ate what the hogs left over and wouldn't eat. That's what he got. I'd say this kid pretty well hit his bottom, wouldn't you? He was on his way. Something important happened. And here's what has happened. It says he came to himself. This is what we had to do. He came to himself. He says, "My father has much. His servants have much. They eat well. They live well. See? And I starve." Here's the next thing he says, and this is what we had to do too. He says, "I will arise and go to my father and tell him I am unworthy." See? "I will throw myself upon his mercy." So this kid starts that long, that painful trip way back from that far country back home. And what happened? Did his father chew him out? Nope, it says in the Bible that his father saw him coming afar off. And he ran to him and fell on his neck and kissed him. He says, "My son who is dead is alive." He says, "Let us make merry. Let's have a feast. Let's have food. Let's have dancing. Let's have music." So, boy, they have a blast up there. They're having a great old time up there at the house. They're eating and drinking. He says, "Put a cloak on his back, a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet. My son who is dead is alive. Let us make merry." So they're making merry, boy. Meanwhile, this Al-Anon kid, he's out there still working away, like a good Al-Anon should. And he hears all this ruckus up at the house. And a servant came by. He said, "Hey, what's all that ruckus up at the house, that music and stuff?" He says, "Haven't you heard?" He says, "No, what?" He says, "Your brother came home." He says, "Oi, that dirty no good, see?" So at that, he drops his tools and went up to the house to confront his father. Now, this is a very human thing. Very human. He goes to his father, he says, "Father, I have always been a good son to you, dutiful, done what you ask and more. This dirty, stinking brother of mine took his inheritance and blew it on riotous living. He comes home and you have a party for him." He said, "You never had a party for me, father." Father had to explain why. This is a great story of the second chance, the forgiveness. See? Now, well, there's rummies in the Bible. I can give you more, but I'm not going to talk any more about those. There they are. This has been going on a long time. Why do we walk into here and recover from a hopeless situation? Alcoholism, as I said, is probably the oldest malady that afflicts the human race. All down through these centuries, the alcoholic has only had two options. He can go crazy or die or both. About 40 years ago, when this program was put together and started as Alcoholics Anonymous, the alcoholic got a third option. He can go crazy, he can die, or he can get well. This never happened before. Never. You and I are the blessed ones. We're blessed with this opportunity of life and real life, wonderful life. We don't have to live that anymore. We don't have to exist that way anymore. There's a change. Now, if I could tell you about the problems that we had to cope with in those early days. Everyone had that same idea that those people did about the Good Samaritan, that guy laying out in the alcoholic is a no-good SOB, and he's less than human. This has been handed down from generation to generation. People have been conditioned to believe this. So they run around yet today. I heard about one of them today here, one of your in your group, a wife of one of the boys here. So scared to let anybody know this guy belongs to AA. That's pitiful. What kind of a crazy, foolish pride is that? You know, I'm not anonymous. I never have been, and I never will be. I don't think that's our function to hide from people. And I don't think it's our function to hide from each other. I want to know who my friends are. I want to know your name. If I see notes hanging on club rooms, "Joe P. is in Mount Park Hospital." Who in the hell is Joe P.? How am I going to send Joe P. a card or go to see him? There's probably 44 of them in the hospital, see? I want you to know me, and I want to know you. I'm not ashamed of my membership here. I am proud of it. I was one time very ashamed of myself and for people to know what I was and so forth. No longer do I have to hide from anybody. I had all those fears years ago. I have them no more. I get an awful lot of criticism. I've had it for years because of my lack of what some people call anonymity. You know what anonymity means to me? It means this. I don't care who in the world knows I am an AA. I never did. You have my permission to tell anybody that Clarence Snyder is a member of AA. But I have no right to go out and tell anybody that you do without your permission. That's all it means. This is not a secret society where we hide from each other and everybody else. How do you think this thing ever started? How do you think it ever got going? Somebody had to go out and put their chin out. Somebody had to go out and talk to all these people who had had something to do with alcoholics. We had to establish hospitals. We had to establish dry out places. We had to establish meetings, groups. We had to talk to people and get some support. Now we got a wonderful press. Gee, you find something about AA in the newspapers, magazines, funny papers, movies, everything is in there. Why hide? Don't hide. Why should you hide? You're wrong if you do. I'll tell you why you're wrong. You and I are the only people who have the gift and the talent for fixing rummies. All these thousands of years, a lot of people have tried. Smarter people than you and I. Their scorecard's not so hot. But there isn't an alcoholic sitting in this room that doesn't have a talent to go out and help another person change his entire life and give him a life. This is what we have here. We should value this. We shouldn't hide it. It's ridiculous. Now, tell me something. Why do people come in here? Let me say something about alcoholism and alcoholics. You know, everyone can't be an alcoholic, really. That's a privilege reserved for a chosen few. I don't think that over 7 or 8% of the population can be an alcoholic. They're just not made that way. Alcoholics are different than people. Really, really. There are a lot of drunks. Every alcoholic is a drunk, but every drunk is not an alcoholic. I've met a lot of drunks that don't have sense enough to be an alcoholic. It's the truth. They're stupid. Alcoholics are not stupid. They're anything but. Alcoholics are a class all by themselves, and you should be proud that you are one. I'll tell you why. To be an alcoholic, I'm not talking about a stupid drunk, I'm talking about an alcoholic. You have certain characteristics. I can tell an alcoholic by looking at him. I don't have to smell him. Really. I made this remark a week or so ago. Grace and I were down in the Cayman Islands, down in British West Indies. We were asked to come down there and try to help them do something about their Alcoholics Anonymous, which has just been around there for 5 years and nobody's doing anything. And while down there, I talked to a lot of people, all the service clubs, but one talk I made was to the police department. They brought every one of those policemen in there for this meeting in the afternoon, men police and women police. And I start talking about it, and I've made this same statement. I says, I can tell an alcoholic to look at him. Yeah? So one of the women cops says to me, can you tell me the alcoholics are sitting in here? I says, yes, I can. She says, tell me. I says, I can't do that publicly, but I'll see you afterward, and I'll show you some of them in here that are rummies. So on the way out, she sidled up to me. I says, see that one there?
Yeah, she says, he's one.
Yeah. He's that, and you're cheap, too. Yeah, he is. Even the governor. You know, I'll bet this has happened to you. It's happened to me many times. I'll be walking down a street, and some panhandler's coming down 2 blocks down the street, and he'll pass 15 people in to put the arm on me. Why? A brother under the skin. He knows me. He don't smell me. He feels me. This is right. Let me tell you what the alcoholic's made of. To be an alcoholic, you have to be something special. You do. Believe me. I've never met an alcoholic worthy of the name who is not a high-strung individual. Very high-strung. He's very impulsive. He don't do any, you know, he's not a deep thinker. You never find an alcoholic thinking. If he thinks, he gets in trouble. He don't think, he emotes, he feels. That's why you can't, no alcoholic's gonna accept this program till he hurts. You can do all the talk, all the damn common sense you want in the world to him. He's not going to do any good. But when he hurts enough, he'll take this program. See? So, he's not a deep thinker, but he's a quick one. He's got a wealth of imagination and ingenuity. He'll out-lie anybody in the world. He's the biggest liar that ever wore shoes. He's lonely and he's sensitive. Very sensitive soul. He's always running around looking to tell me their problems, and I understand them. They need a program to salvage the best people they have in their employ. The alcoholic is something special, so don't ever apologize for being an alcoholic. And don't ever deny it. Be proud. You have something that other people don't have. You got a talent that other people don't have, and you better use it. Because it tells me in a good book that we use the talent. If we don't use our talent, we lose it. If you don't believe that, read the parable of the talents in the Bible. Find out what happened to the guy that didn't use his one talent. Took it away from him, threw him out. We have this talent. You and I have responsibility. The alcoholic can operate on probably 40% of his efficiency and compete and beat other people that are operating on 80% of theirs. I can tell you what I did in my own experience. I don't want to go into it, but I took a job after I'd been fired off the first one that I'd had for 9 years. They gave me an executive job in a company that I had to build a department. And I was drunk the day they hired me. I was drunk every night for 3.5 years that I worked for that bunch. And I did them a terrific job. And when they finally had to fire me, they had to hire 13 people to take my place. No kidding. Hell, I never let them know what I was doing. We are slick. We're connivers. Well, funny thing, when they finally had to let me go, they gave me a going-away party. I got fired and they have a going-away party. This is a rummy for you. Well, anyway, what is alcoholism? I told you what an alcoholic is. He's different than people. Great person. What's alcoholism? Most people talk about alcoholism as being a matter of taste. They say, boy, that guy must love his liquor. He drinks 2 or 3 quarts a day. Actually, I have met very few alcoholics that like to taste the booze. And if you don't believe that, get on the bum like I was, and you'll drink anything. I paid 7 cents a pint for my booze, and I bought it in a wallpaper store. I always had 2-gallon jugs of it, too. If you think I drank that stuff because of its palatable virtues, try it sometime. Turn you inside out. And other people talk about it being a habit. It's not a habit. We're all creatures of habit. We do most of the things in daily life by force of habit. Habit saves a lot of wear and tear on the brains. But this is... Sure. Get up in the morning. What do you do in the morning? Go through the same old routine. You're half awake. You take your shower and put your right sock on first and your left and on. The only thing you have to think about getting dressed is if you're going to have a purple tie with a yellow suit or something, you know. Figure out your color scheme. That's about it. Then you take the bus or get your car and go to work and go through the same bloody routine day after day. Habit, 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 habit. See? If this were a habit, we would have taken care of this a long time ago. Because any habit we have, we can break with a little suffering and a little guts. This habit of smoking that most alcoholics carry on to excess, if a doctor came along and told you if you didn't quit smoking, you'd be dead in 30 days. There isn't a monkey in here that wouldn't quit in 3 days. It would hurt. But we do it. So it's not a matter of taste. It's not a matter of habit. Drinking to an alcoholic is something entirely different. It's an obsession. It's a way of life. It's a drive. When I was a drinking alcoholic, this is when I was still able to associate with decent company and operate in business. Whenever I was invited to something, no matter what, if I was going to a picnic, I was going to a ball game, I was going to a show, I was going to a business conference, or a funeral, or a wedding, or what have you, first thing I had to consider was a liquor situation. Is there going to be booze there? How much and how quick can I get it? No booze, no clearance. Very simple life. But if I had to go someplace at a respectable party and expect to suck on a highball all night long, I would go there half knockered and take my own jug with me and ditch it somewhere and steal all my host liquor I get my hands on. I did this when I was still in respectable company. What do you call that? Something wrong up here. I had an obsession. There was a drive that I couldn't overcome. Now, to overcome an obsession is a lot different than overcome a habit or a taste situation. This taste thing would be the easiest thing, you know. Who wants to... I could cultivate a taste for something else, like apples or bananas. I don't know who wants to eat 40 bananas a day, but... So, it's an obsession. The only way I know to overcome is an obsession. The only way I know is to change the whole pattern of my life. Where once upon a time the idea of a drink was the most important thing in my life, I had to change that where the idea of a drink is the most ridiculous thing in my life. How do I do this? I'm not able to do it by myself. So, I'm introduced to a program. Let me tell you what this program is. When I came here, we didn't have this 12-step program. We had a 6-step program in the Oxford movement, and all of that 6-step program was taken from the Sermon on the Mount and the Book of James. So that's where your 12-step program comes from, too. So somebody gets yapping about it. There's the source of our program. So we have no copyright on it. Nobody has a copyright on the Sermon on the Mount. Okay, we can all use it. So this program, 6 steps, was designed to change my life. They called it a life-changing program. When the book was written, we took those 6 steps and made 12 steps out of them. We figured if alcoholics could screw up 6 steps, they could screw up 12 much easier. And they do. So here we are. Let's go into this program. I want to tell you what it means to me and how this program, what it really means to you and how to accept it and how to use it and how to profit from it. Our program is divided in 4 phases. The first phase is the first step, the phase of admittance. It says in that first step, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. Hey, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable. Well, that's quite an admission. 2 things. I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. Well, if I can't manage my life, I better hire a manager. Isn't that simple enough? I can't do it, so I hire a manager. So the second phase of this program is the 2nd through 7th steps. And this is a phase of submission, where I submit my will and my life to the care of my new manager, whom I call God. Right here, I want to say one thing, just for the benefit of a lot of people that are always straining at gnats and swallowing camels. There's only one God that I believe in. Some guy will say, well, what about all these guys that believe in Mohammed and believe in Zen and all? Honey, they got dead ones. I got a live God. If they want a dead God, that's too tough. I don't want them. I want a live one who I can communicate with. So the 2nd through 7th step is submission, where I submit my will and my life to the care of my new manager. Second step says, I came to believe. It didn't say I believed that when I got here. Not by a long shot. It says, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. You hear a lot of people start to squawk. You say, I'm not nuts. Well, listen, kids, if you're not nuts, you don't belong here. This is the greatest collection of nuts in the world. So this is the first qualification. You got to be nuts. If you don't think you're nuts, just look back on some of the things you did when you were drunk. Ask yourself, are those the addicts of a sane person? I don't have to say any more about that. Be glad you're nuts, because it got you here. So, all right. Third step says, I made a decision. Now, that in itself is something for a rummy to do. We are the most indecisive people in the world. Made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of my new manager. How do you like that? I'm going to turn my will and life over to the care of this ethereal creature way out in the blue yonder, who's way out in that outer space, who I've been running away from for years and scared to death of. Not on your life, kids, unless I hurt real badly. See? See how I talk? It's not common sense. It's emotion. It's how I feel. I do everything on feeling. If I hurt badly enough, I'll do that. If I don't, I won't. That's where I stop right now. There's where people in AA get their first and their fatal stumble is in step three. They try to hold reservations. He says, okay, but, well, I'm an atheist. I'm an agnostic. Horse feathers. I get this crap all the time. It says something in our fifth chapter. If you want to come into this fellowship, there's a qualification. It says very plainly in the fifth chapter, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you are now ready to take certain steps. If you don't qualify for that, what are you doing here? That's the qualification. Alcoholics, one characteristic of the alcoholic is this, and it's so important. We are all extremists. We never do anything by halfway measures. When an alcoholic works, he works hard, he plays hard. When he gets drunk, he makes a career out of it. And believe me, when we want to recover, it has to be with the same verve. Right. Because we are extremists. There's no halfway measures in our